A word of prayer, please. Our Father, we just continue to praise your name for this day. We thank you for the beauty of it and just for the privilege to be alive and to be here in this place and to experience all of the opportunities that we have to learn and to share and to interact with one another. We thank you that you are a social God which calls us to interpersonal relationships where we can share and grow and learn to love one another. We thank you particularly for the emphasis of this week upon youth ministry and for the ideas which these men have brought to us to consider youth ministry as a part of our whole ministry in the church. And so we turn over to you this hour and pray that your name may be glorified through all that is said here. In Jesus' name, amen. We've had sort of a slight modification in the topic for this afternoon, and that Art is going to zero in primarily on the area of youth programming, which I think has been a problem if you've been in youth work, as I have, for all of us. And so he's going to kind of confine himself to this, and later in the week, we'll announce at another time the presenting of the gospel through personal evangelism. So Art will speak for about 40 minutes, and then we'll have about a 20-minute discussion period following that and cut off at 5 o'clock. So the first response, the first question at 4:40 will be brought by Jim Dorado as soon as he arrives. And then following that, we'll open up the discussion to the floor. So that'll be the format for this afternoon. Art?
Just to give you a quick background, in case you weren't in a class this morning that I was in, I come from a community church. It's a Methodist church. We would consider our area a square mile. So we're right in the middle of it. Now the square mile is, there's a freeway over here, one of those freeways that conveniently divides up a city. There is Lake Street, which is a major intersection here. There's a Powderhorn Park, big park up there over here. And 38th Street down here. This is a mile, and this is a mile, one square mile. Can you hear me everywhere in this room? Any problem? We're right in the middle. Now, Central High School is two blocks away, and it's got 900 kids in it. It's equipped for 1,600 kids. It dropped back down to about 600, and it's built up to 900 now, mainly because they have a number of suburban kids coming in what they call a magnet school program. Bryant Junior High has 1,000 students over here. It's junior high. It's about four blocks away from us. And one block away is Mann Elementary School. Mann Elementary School was built in 1886 to house 500 kids. Last year we had 1,000 kids in that building. The third floor is condemned. We can't use it. So what they did is they took the sixth graders and moved them over here to the junior high. So the junior high is 6th, 7th, 8th, and 9th grade. And then we've got some kids here. We've brought it back down to about 700. And we bus some more kids out to another school so that we can get it down to a feasible number. We find ourselves here in this community, the only evangelical church that's got any kind of outreach to it at all. Most of the churches in our community have either died or have a constituency that would be 60 years old or older. In other words, there isn't any church work going on right now in this community right here. And yet there's probably 2,500 kids of an elementary, junior high, and senior high level right in our own area. So this is the situation we find ourselves in. I think another thing to help you set your mind as to what's going on here is Dr. Heinerman, who is the president of the Good News Movement within the Methodist Church, has been here at Park for 23 years. That's kind of unheard of. I think that's one of the reasons why Park is still there. And I've been at Park Avenue for 5.5 years. And I think that will help you. I just mentioned the breakdown in our community. No, I won't. I'll do that tonight.
I wanted to talk about youth programming. And since I came from Young Life, which was an independent organization, into the church, into an organization I never really wanted to go into. I went through seminary, but never wanted to go into a church. Yet I found myself forced into a church for a number of different reasons. I'd say that one of the things that that I would want to deal with in terms of program, I would say that the man who runs the program, I'd like to talk a little bit about what kind of a man he has to be. I think he has to be a man that's committed to kids for kids ministry for his life, at least as far as God wants him to be committed to youth ministry. Like Jim said, not a stepping stone. Some of the things I stepped into when I walked into Park Church was that I was, if a kid was 16 years old, I was about the eighth cat that he had come in to direct the program for him. There was about a every 2 year turnover. And so what would happen was the kids were very cynical, and they'd sit back and they'd say, here comes, what's his name, Art Erickson. Now let's see what his bag of tricks is. And let's see what his program is, and he'll give it to us for about 2 years, and then he'll leave. And they kind of cynically laid back and categorized me. You know, they said, now Lou was a better speaker, and the guy before us had a more program going on. And they kind of categorize your abilities and your talents and then expect you to move on. And they didn't bargain for me staying longer. And we've had a lot of fun with that because they have a tendency to do this because we've kept moving on in this kind of a pattern. So he's got to be committed. I'd say that a primary ingredient of the man that's going to go into youth work has got to be his integrity and his consistency and his faithfulness. There is nothing worse than promising a kid something and having it fall through. Now, we have an athletic program on our blacktop and back that probably has 150 to 200 kids in it. And we've got a number of different coaches that have come through there. And this year, for a lot of different reasons, we have only guys, our own kids, coaching. We can't get adults and outsiders to coach, so our own kids are doing the coaching. And the one thing that comes through that they can tolerate and admire and play under, even though a coach might not be the best one, is the guy shows up every day. And the one thing they can't tolerate, no matter how good a ball player he is, no matter how charismatic a personality is if he hits only 3 out of the 5 practices a week. Consistency, integrity, what you say and what you are being one, being an integral person. Consistency is the greatest personal attribute you've got to have in youth ministry. I don't think you have to be brilliant. I don't think you have to know it all. I think you have to be 1 week ahead of your kids in your personal growth. Kids are growing. They're going to force you to grow. And if you're 1 week ahead of them, that's all you need to be. Now, I would hope we'd be more than that, being seminary trained and all. But that having a seminary training doesn't mean you're growing. And I mean growing in your personal life. You can be 1 week ahead of your kids. And that's important. I think that you've got to have the ability or at least the insight that you've got 4 worlds you've got to break into. When I came to Park, I had to break into 4 worlds. There was the church kid world. That is the kid that went to church to Park Avenue all his life. I had to break into his world. And he was strange because those kids had never really had anybody that tried to break into their own world. And in many cases, their own parents. Secondly, I had to break into the non-church kids world. Thirdly, I had to break into the adult world. And fourthly, I had to break into my own professional peer group level world. And maybe in some cases that was the toughest. Because there's a terrible amount, there's a fantastic amount of hiddenness, of jealousy, of competition, of all sorts of problems within that professional level. And in some respects, it's just a dead world. Now, how do you begin to break in to a kid's world? I think I'll cover that later. I think another thing that you have to have as a person, at least in our setting, and I'd say in any setting, you have to be deculturalized. Now, we have a setting that has Chippewa Indian, black, white, some Spanish American, and suburban. There's 5 identifiable cultures right there. You've got others. You've got the different age groups. You've got a number of different subcultures connected with our church and our setting. And I dare say that if you're in a setting like a small town that doesn't have a lot of these subcultures, you still have to be deculturalized. You have to be deculturalized because you have to have wrestled through the question, what is of my culture and what is uniquely Christian? Now, I'd say that it's got to be phrased a couple of different ways. One of them, I said, what's distinctly cultural and what's uniquely Christian in my life? And there's three other questions that have to go along with that. What's my culture and how can I break out of it? What's my culture and how can Christ break into it? And how can God break me? Now, those are very important because for so long, we have wrapped up our Christianity in our culture. We have put the two together. And the counterculture came and it just smashed the church. Because the counterculture attacked everything that the culture was. Now, it threw the baby out with the bathwater. But still, it helped define the culture and laugh at it and say, aren't you guys ridiculous? And for a lot of people, their Christianity and their culture were wrapped up together. And they couldn't handle the whole thing. And they couldn't handle the counterculture people could be Christian. That's the thing that really blew their mind. That you could be anti-culture, at least anti-this culture, and you could still be Christian. And they just couldn't handle it. And I have to say that Christianity will express itself differently in black culture, in Indian culture, in white culture, white city culture, white suburban culture, in South America, in Asia. Wherever it goes, Christianity is distinct from cultural hang-ups. Now, the question is, what's of my culture and how can I break out of it myself and see that? What is my culture and how can Christ break into it and how can I be a broken person? Those are all crucial questions. And I say that because if I haven't wrestled that through, I'm not sure I have a pure gospel anywhere I go. And if you go into a city situation, you're going to be forced to wrestle it through and you're going to go through a terrible ripping up process where you will have to make these distinctions and then begin to pull your faith back together and build it up again. And it'll be a stronger faith. But you may get destroyed in the process because we've wrapped it up so much together so far. And so the man that's going to go into youth programming will have to wrestle through some of these things and have some of these attributes. Now, in terms of basic principles that we work on in youth programming at Park Avenue, I'd say that one of the first things I'd like to talk to is that we have a concept of... Just don't blow your nose in it, you'll mess up the board. We've tried to distill what is it that we want to build our program around, what are the elements in it, and this is what we have distilled as the basic elements that we have to go through in our program. We feel that to build a viable program, you have to have what we call pre-evangelism. You have to do some spade work. You have to cultivate your land before you put the seed in it. And in some cases, you have to do a lot of it. And I'd say in the city, you have to do more of it than you do in the suburbs. You have to do some pre-evangelism work. Then you do your evangelism in whatever way you want to do it, or whatever way you feel led to do it. Once you have some kids that have come into a relationship with Christ, you have to do some bodybuilding. You have to bring them into the church. You have to bring them into a concept of fellowship. You have to bring them into a concept of relationship with God and each other. And then, once they've built themselves up to a point where they're strong enough, they go into some kind of mission endeavor, or you send them. You give them an assignment. And then they go into pre-evangelism, evangelism, bodybuilding missions. We drew it like this in a circle because if you put it across the board straight, it would be static. And it's not static. It's constantly, it's dynamic. That is, that just because a kid is here doesn't mean he can't be doing this. You see, because obviously a kid that is a Christian is going to be saying something about it. But it's just that if you're going to build any kind of strength into your kids, you're going to have to send them through this process. And you're going to have that time where you have a year or two or three, however long it takes for a kid to mature, to some kind of a depth in his life and some kind of understanding. Then you can begin to send them out. And so this is one of our basic things that we work with, that this has to be the way we function in our program. We have a principle that we work with that is called the Lazarus principle. The Lazarus principle is that Lazarus had a miracle performed on his life. He was dead for 3 days, and God healed him, and he came out. I don't know how he walked out of there. I don't know if he floated. I don't know if he just went a little bit at a time, but he came out of that tomb. It said he stinketh. And they had to begin to unwrap him before he was really a free person. And when a kid becomes a Christian, that's the miracle. That is the miracle that God performs in his life of conversion. But there's a lot of stinking wrapping you got to do to get that kid down to where he's a free person. And there's a lot of things you have to work through. And we try to make a distinction between the miracle of his conversion and that process of unwrapping and beginning to look at some of the things that have putrefied in his life. And he begins to unwrap, and then he can become a free person. I think we have to recognize that there's different age levels. And this is the way we've broken it down on age levels. We have a different approach for each age level. Now, I'm sure that there's lots of things that can go on in these age levels that we're not looking at. But basically, this is the way we've broken it down. We have a summer program, and in the year-round program, but especially in our summer do we employ this, that we take the third and the fourth grader, and we make a distinction between him and the fifth and sixth grader, and we make a distinction between the seventh and the eighth, and the ninth and tenth, and the 11th and 12th. And the distinction is basically this, if we could categorize it. The third and fourth grader, first of all, physically, he's a beautiful kid. He's just proportioned right. I don't know if you know many third and fourth grade kids, but they're just great kids. They're friendly. They're outgoing. They want to hang all over you. You never walk around with one third or fourth grader in camp. You always walk around with about a dozen, and they're all over you. You're like a Christmas tree. They're just great, affectionate, warm bodies, and they love fantasy. They love stories. And so the more fantasy you can throw at them, and you know who's great at fantasy? C.S. Lewis. C.S. Lewis speaks to those kids in a beautiful way. The Land of Narnia series especially. And so in our camps, for instance, The Witch, the Lion, and the Wardrobe, our camp is Land of Narnia. We got all the settings out there, and everybody in camp is a Drid, and a Sprite, an Ifrit, or whatever the characters are that he has with it, good guys and the bad guys. And we put them into the Land of Narnia. And the lion and the witch have this terrible struggle. And the lion, Aslan, represents Christ. And you know, for a kid to begin to relate to this lion, Aslan, this powerful, strong, yet soft, fuzzy, warm lion, is a beautiful, beautiful figure for him to begin to build into his concept of Christ. I have no hang-up on that. And neither do the kids. And they have no problem making the adjustment from Aslan and the witch to the struggle that goes on between Christ and the opposition. Oh, hey, thanks. Okay, so fantasy. Now, you get into fifth and sixth grade. They don't like fantasy. It really helps the fifth and the sixth grader if it was rooted in history. If it really happened, they like it. Well, you've got a tremendous wealth of material there in either Old Testament history or New Testament history, and we just plug them into that, things that really happen.
You get into the 7th and 8th, and they're looking for models. They are looking for heroes,
particularly if those heroes can be matched, the older heroes can be matched up with present heroes. And I'm not sure the content is important to these kids here in this age bracket as important as it is to have people, live human bodies working with them that are beginning to form human, warm, live, fleshly figures in front of them that they can begin to know and identify with. I think this is an age where the model, the human model, is the most important. And the 7th and 8th graders, by the way, are very submerged in their personality. That's why content doesn't go over. They don't really like to talk content through so much as they like to just soak it all up. I'm not saying they don't discuss and they don't have a lot to say, but they love to soak up material. You see, the 3rd and 4th grader is a very active, outgoing, transparent person. And to a large degree, the 5th and the 6th grader is transparent. But the 7th and 8th grader, they're going through their physical changes right now. Certain things are developing, certain places that never were there before. And they're getting stretched out, and they're awkward, and they can't play games like they used to. They're uncoordinated. And they just kind of wish they could wear a shawl all the time and kind of disappear. They'll never move alone. They always check the environment to see what's happening. And if you get 10 junior high kids, you'll get 100. And if you get 100, you get 500. I mean, it's just that way. It steamrolls. And if you ever want to wipe out a program, just go in and really promote it with junior high kids, and you'll get so many that you either can't handle it, or you'll chase everybody else away, or they'll wreck the place. You know, they're just monkeys in the trees. You know, they're wild. But they're really impressionable. And what happens here is they go underground. They subterfuge there, and they don't have a lot of ego strength at that age. They don't have a lot of stuff that's their own opinions, etc. They'll mouth a lot of other people's opinions. Then comes 9th grade, and they begin to emerge in 9th grade. Right now, the 9th graders right now are beginning to stretch out. They're getting to a mature height. They're gaining a lot of athletic ability. We can put our 9th grade basketball team against the sophomores, and they'll beat them. They're just beginning to come out now, and their personal identity is starting to emerge. And this is a beautiful time to quit working with a group and start working with individuals. Because as their personal identity, and they're beginning to have their own ideas on things now, and the group doesn't become so important to them, and they're starting to get a little bit more moody. And in their moodiness, they're starting to work out a lot of inner, deep, personal things. And it's a great time to just forget all the group stuff and start working with individuals. Right at this age. It's also crucial, we find, it's crucial to pick them up at 9th grade, because in a junior high program that goes 7th through 9th, you understand that next fall they're going to be up in the senior high. And those are all the big, bad people up there. And right now they're scared to go up there. And so there's a great crack in their life where there's a lot of fear, and they haven't made it up there yet, and they're just very open to all sorts of friendships and all sorts of friendly bodies coming around and befriending them and saying nice things to them and building them up and defining them and saying good things about themselves. They love it, and they need it. Also, I'd say if we don't reach a kid by the time he's in 9th grade, just before he goes into high school, we are going to have a very tough time reaching him. The sophomore year, he's still scared. The sophomore year, he's low man on the totem pole. He has absolutely no sense of responsibility. The junior year, the sophomore year is only exceeded by the junior year, where he has less sense of responsibility, and he's learned to play the games more, and he's really living high school life now. I mean, you just can't touch a junior unless he's got the bottom falling out at home or something. He's just having terrible problems. He's just living high school life right to the hilt. Now, by the time a kid's a senior, you see, he's thinking about next year I'm not going to be back and I got to go to the Army, I got to work, I'm going to get married, I'm going to have to take a job. And the problem there is he develops a hopelessness. You know, I've blown it. And now all of a sudden I'm faced with the realities of the world. He can be open and he can be a very frustrated, pessimistic kid too. But I'd like to suggest and see more people working with junior high kids, even though it's frustrating, and beginning to pick them up at the ninth grade level when they begin to emerge and really building something solid. And then taking those kids through high school so they don't have to go through all this other garbage. It's conceivable a kid doesn't have to go through that garbage if he's reached down here. But it's frustrating to do it here. But let me also say that in young life, we just work up here with the 10th through 11th. You see? And a whole new world opened up to me when I began to see that you can really build solid foundations down here. I came to building a summer program the first summer I was there at Park Avenue, and I put second, third, and fourth graders together, just to show you how naive I was. I put second, third, and fourth graders together, and I called one of the gals in the community. I said, I've saved a week, and we're going to put second, third, and fourth graders. She said, well, she's very wise. She said, do you really think you want second graders there? She didn't say, you stupid oaf. She said, do you really think you want second graders? I said, well, I don't know. I don't know any second graders. I thought it would be a good time to start. She said, well, I think you'll find that they get homesick and they're too insecure to go up to a camp situation. So I said, okay, we'll start with third graders. Well, now I know some second graders, and I know that they're too insecure and they get homesick. They really do. There's a big difference between a second grader and a third grader. And so that's this whole new world that opened up to me. That it's just amazing what you can do in building lives down here all the way through. And isn't it amazing what you've got? You've got the possibility of following kids through in a church situation all the way through, so that if you really build a solid building block program and begin to put some input into kids, you've really got something at the end of 10, 12 years. Isn't that wild? Now, that quickly, I want to just give a definition of success for a youth program. You don't have to write it down. It's very simple. I would say that any program that turns out at the end of the senior year, a half a dozen solid, growing, mature Christians is a successful youth program. Now, that may sound like an awful lot to some of you, and it may sound like nothing to some of you, but I just say that if you turn out 6 kids every year, solid, growing, aware, mature Christians for the senior year in high school level, I'd say you have a good program, because I don't know too many churches that are turning out kids that are solid, half a dozen of them. I don't know too many churches that are turning out 1. And if they do, it's because that family did the job. So, if you can develop a program that at the end of the senior year is producing that kind of thing, I'd say you've got a successful program. And just remember that the Lord only had 11 men that he had spent 3 years with, and they really did the job. Now, he had 500 other people that he visited, but he had 11 that he came back to and that he built his entire work on. And I'm saying, if we are doing the same thing as youth directors, as youth programmers, whatever you're going to go into, if you're producing that kind of growth, then you've got something. I think a very important thing as a principle of our programming here is that every corner is different. And you're going to hear me say it a couple more times, because it's the most important thing for my mental health that I live with. Every corner is different. And if I tried to judge my work against anybody else's work, I'd go batty. I'd leave the ministry. Every corner is different. Every church is different. Every man is different. Woman that's going to run a program is different. And your measuring stick for success has got to be different. I'll give you one example. I went to Dave Main's church, Circle Campus, University of Chicago, Illinois, Chicago campus. Dave Main's has 450 people that meet every Sunday in a union hall. Dave Main's has built up a very successful ministry with graduate students and professor types. I went in there, talked with Dave. My dad has had a chance to get to know Dave. He goes to the church there. Dave said to my dad once, "The biggest problem I've got is I've got too many talented people." He said, "I have a hard time keeping people here with all that talent when I can't use them all. They'll go someplace where they're going to be used." Now let me tell you, I don't have that problem. I don't have that problem. My problem is we don't have any talented people, you know. We don't have the expertise that Dave Maines has at a graduate school level with a specific type of individual person. And if I were to measure my success, and my initial response when I went there was, wow, where have I been? You know, I got nothing to show for my ministry. And yet I had to remember, and I had to remind myself of this, that every corner is different. And if Dave Maines came to Park Avenue Church, he would have a different ball game. You see? And if I went to his place, I'd have a different ball game. And every situation, whether it's rural, inner city, suburban, a campus church, whatever it is, everything's different. And you are responsible only to God, to your gifts and what you've been given, to work the best that you can in terms of your ministry. And you've got to maintain that for your own mental health. That makes sense? When you get into it, it'll make more sense. Okay, I'd say that getting into to another area here, if the man has to be discussed, and we talk some principles there of total programming, the next thing that has to be done is you have to build a leadership team. Now, I believe I'm called by God to be a youth minister. I believe I got to have my pilot project. I believe I got to have my ministry. But I refuse to be paid by a church to be the bumblebee that goes around gathering nectar at every flower. You see, I got 200 kids in the program and the church rolls. I refuse to be the one that goes around and does the pastoral call on every one of the 200 kids every 6 months or every year or whatever it is. And that's my job. I also am getting tired of being paid to minister to kids whose parents are abdicating the responsibility of Christian education. I'm tired of the fact that when a kid fails to grasp the whole picture here, it's my fault. I am not going to blame the church if my kids fail to get the picture. I am responsible for seeing that my kids get basic Christian education. I really believe I'm responsible to see my kids get their basic education and they get their values. I think I send my kids off to school to pick up some specialized areas of content. But their value system toward books and their basic building blocks of learning are going to come from me, or else I haven't done the job. And I believe the same in the church. Now, how can we begin to get people who have abdicated this responsibility for so long to begin to do this in their own home? And how do we develop a leadership team in specialized youth programming to do the specialized kind of tasks is another thing. And I would say that first of all, you've got to have your own pilot project. I think secondly, you've got to find your people. There are people there. You've got to find them. I just like to quote Jim Rayburn, who I grew up under, who said there's enough people within a square mile of every high school to totally evangelize the local school. The problem is finding them, recruiting them, training them to do the job. We just have been very poor in the church of mobilizing the troops to do the job. So we got to find them. I think the next thing we got to do is get them well. Got to get them well. Everybody that comes in has got to be ministered to first. I mean, they got problems. They got hang-ups. They have to find out what it means to be saved in their own personal life. And they have to begin to take steps to growing into maturity. Get them well. Then expose them. Now, how do you expose them? How do you break into that youth culture in the non-church society? It's going to start very basic, and I just want to deal with this for a minute. If you're a youth man, and you're hired to work in a church, and you're going to break into your community, and you're going to get to know kids, where do you get to know them? You send an advertisement out in the local paper, new youth pastor. In town, accessible anytime. Give the address, put up signs. Or do you carry it out to kids? And you got to carry it out. Now, how do you carry it out? Where do kids spend most of their time? In the school. So if you want to know where kids are, and you want to go to where they are, where do you go? To school. Where are you not welcomed? To school. State law. We have security police in our particular school. We got 5 security cops. You're not supposed to be in there. They'll get you if you do. So what do you have to do? You have to make some friendships with the principal. You have to build up a trust level with him. You have to get to know him and explain what you're doing. And tell him that you want to go into the high school for evangelism. Not on your life. The high school is not, or the local school is not, the place for evangelism. You are going there for one thing, pre-evangelism. And I wouldn't even use that word. That's just my mentality. That's the label I put on that. I just want to go where kids are, and I want to get to know them. And nothing more. I just want to know, where are the kids, who are they, and what are they like? And it's beautiful when you get permission to go into a school. And I eat all my lunches in the schools. I eat at the elementary school, I eat at the junior high, and I eat at the high school. The wildest scene is to eat at the elementary school. We just put in hot lunches 3 years ago. And up until then, kids would walk home. And so the hot lunch program came in, and every kid eats in 10 minutes' time. Every 10 minutes, a new batch comes in. And that means for an hour and a quarter, kids are eating lunch. If I eat a real slow lunch, I can eat with every kid in that elementary school. And it's just the funniest thing in the world to see the jolly green giant come in, you know, this huge person, according to those little kids, and sit down at one of those low little things down there. Wildest thing is to get a drink of water around the school. But I really do, and I just eat lunch over there, and I just, you know, and kids wonder, what in the heck are you doing over here? And I try and kid, you know, and say, well, never made it through the first time and trying to get back in. Or some stupid thing like that, and they look at you. And, you know, the first time you go in there, you just feel so awkward. You really do. You just feel like everybody's looking at you, and they are. They are. And you got to have all sorts of little smiles and dumb little things that you do. And they ask you what you're doing there, and just eating this great lunch, and they think you're crazy because they know it's not great, and you do too. But you know, you're not going to say it's a lousy lunch. You just say, hey, I just really love to eat lunch here. And then you begin to ask their name, and pretty soon you begin to break down barriers and break down walls. And so we may have 80 elementary kids in a program that come on Sunday morning, but I'll tell you, I've got 500 elementary friends. I really do. And when we throw a banquet at the church, we threw a banquet once and had 300 kids show up. It was for a kids-only banquet. It was all our buddies. Now, we're faced with a problem of how to take our people and put them in touch with these kids and bring these kids in. You see? But step one is getting to know kids. Step one is getting to know them. And it's just wild for me to take elementary Sunday school teachers and bring them over to lunch with me. Do you know that most parents haven't even gone to eat lunch with their own kids in their own school? And now they're going to come in and they're going to sit down, and the first question of the kids is, what are you doing here? You know, almost like you're breaking into their world. You know, you're not supposed to be there. This is for us. And what's a person like you doing down here? And the same thing in the junior high and the same thing in the high school. That initial feeling of, man, I'm the only one here that's doing this thing and I feel awkward. And then pretty soon, about a week later, 4 or 5 trips like that in, and all of a sudden you're part of the scenery. You blend in. You feel comfortable, they feel comfortable, nobody asks any more questions. And you're on the road to beginning to develop a lot of friendships in your community. Go to ball games. I just love to go to sophomore practices because I'm the only one there. Nobody goes to sophomore practices. Nobody. There aren't a whole lot of people that go to varsity practices, but nobody goes to sophomore practices. They're uncoordinated, they don't do anything right, and the coach is always yelling at them, and they're embarrassed, but there you are. And you're watching practices. When are kids available? They're available from 6 o'clock to 8 in the morning. And you say, 6 o'clock to 8, what do you do with them then? Go out for breakfast. There are kids that we take out for breakfast. They want to know, what are you taking me out for breakfast for? Just want to take out for breakfast. And pretty soon after it's over, they're expecting you to spring a trap on them, you know, or ask a dirty question or something. No question, just wanted to get to know you. And you cement a relationship. You've got a friend for life. I guarantee it. And if a Sunday school teacher goes there, all of a sudden that teacher student relationship takes on a new meaning. Pretty soon you begin to go to school events. And I will make this statement categorically, that of all the football games and all the basketball games and all the baseball games and track meets that I've gone to, I have not seen another minister there for the same reason that I was there in about 15 years of doing this. I saw a Catholic priest come once. And Father Bill Perrin came with his collar on. And that was his greatest mistake, because everybody immediately recognized his symbol, and they quietly, you know, hi, Father. And then he was pretty soon about separated three people away from everybody else, because he was holy territory. And I only saw him at two games. Now, what I'm saying is, where have we been? Where are all those people who work insurance and are in our churches and teaching Sunday school who can flex with their schedule? Where are all those people that get off at 4:30 and can just drop by practice, not to get in the way of the coach, not to get in the way of the practice, but just begin to get to know kids? One of the tools that I love to use is just get a yearbook. This is last year Bryant's junior high yearbook. And if I see a kid I don't know, I look up his face, I see his name, and the next time I walk down the hall, I say, hi, Paul. Paul wondered, who's that? Hey, you know, the worst thing is the people in our own church don't do this. Do you know, I talked to our adult, and I got to quit because I'm running over. And I'll stop with this, and I have to say some more things later on another time. But our own adults, the NICATers class, which means nothing to you, but this is between 40 and 50, and these would, no, it would be less than that, 35 to 50 age. They asked me to come in and talk to them, and I presented the youth program, and they said, now what can we do to help? I said, the greatest thing you can do to help is you have assumed that because you guys have all come up through Park together, that all your kids relate to each other. You relate together well. Now, this is probably a common problem in most churches. You relate together well, and you think automatically your kids are going to love each other. Your kids don't even know each other in most cases. But the greater tragedy is you don't even know each other's kids. So that when you walk down the hall, you talk about reaching the neighborhood and cutting evangelism money and missions money loose for reaching the neighborhood. But you walk down your own hall in church, and you can't even say hi to somebody's kids by their first name that you've been growing up in church with all your life. You see? And so the greatest thing would be for you to begin to befriend kids. Now, don't go up to a kid and go on this big project, I said. Don't go up and just say, hi, what's your name? And expect 15 minutes of deep conversation. That you don't do that in any other area. What you do is you just hang around the halls. And you're down by the water fountain, and you hear some conversation going on, and you see somebody come up and say, hi, Joel, and you put Joel with that face. Okay. Then you're walking down the hall later, you say, hi, Joel. And for the first time in 16 years, you've said hi to Joel by his first name, and all of a sudden Joel will wonder, you know, who's that guy? He's recognizing me. Now, don't stop. Just keep walking. Just say, hi, Joel, and play it kind of cool. Now, the next time you see Joel, ask him a question. Joel, how's school? Fine. Don't stop and have a big conversation. Just leave it there. Fine. That may be all the communication you'll have with Joel. Next time you ask Joel, do you play any sports, Joel? Or how did the team do last night? And you begin to develop a relationship with a kid. Now, does that make sense? Isn't that about as basic as you can get between two human beings? Developing some kind of communication process, and yet we don't do that in the church. We don't do that with people who have been raised in the church all their life and their own kids, and yet we're supposed to bring in hordes of new people out of the community into the church for this great bodybuilding fellowship. Doesn't make sense, you see? And so principle number one would be to just get to know people. Just begin to break down some of these barriers by getting names, etc. And it really begins as simple as that in most cases. Well, Jim.
As I sat listening to Art, I couldn't help but feel that two basic things, having been a pastor, that loom largely before me is, number one, whether my priorities are in fact people or programs. And what he is saying, I'm afraid, is not going to be implemented in your life until you determine that the priorities of your ministry are people. The greatest insult that will ever be hurled at you as a pastor will be when somebody says, I wanted to talk to you, Pastor, but I know how busy you are. I wanted to talk to you, Pastor, but I know how busy you are. And when somebody comes up to me, a kid on a college campus or during a youth conference or during a youth retreat, and says, Jimmy, I wanted to see you, but I know how busy you are. My question is, busy doing what? If I'm too busy to be available to those to whom God has sent me to minister. And all that Art has said is going to be easily pushed aside by most of you by the common rationalizations of the pastorate that says, that all sounds great, Art, but man, I got to go out and raise some money for the new budget, and the Lazy Aid Society is meeting this week, and they want me to come down, pray over the cookies, and then the Spit and Whittle Club has got a little thing going next week, and I've got to program that, and I've got to spend 4 hours a day in my study, which you'll never do, and I've got to prepare 4 or 5 messages this week, and if you do 1 or 2 really prepare them, you'll be doing better than average. And by the time the whole thing is over, we begin to recognize that we don't have time for people. Really, they become more of an interruption than a purpose for our ministry. Now, that might sound very negative and very cynical, but the fact of the matter is, if this is going to be implemented in your life, you're going to have to begin to discover some creative ways of developing a ministry that allows the priority of people to be central. And the other thing I could not help but think of is the fact that communication, which we don't have time to go into here, even this week, which is a favorite subject of mine in lecture. Communication is not what's said, it's what's heard. Communication is not what's said, it's what's felt. Communication is not what's said, it's our ability to be able to listen. And so many times, our inability to listen stifles communication. So you scratch where it doesn't itch. And scratching where it doesn't itch long enough produces irritation. You preach about things that are not issues and answer questions that have hassled you when you were a teenager, and you feel so secure in the fact that now, having fought that battle and won that victory and discovered that truth, you've got to preach it, only to find out that that is not the question that the kid is asking. But you've not walked the corridors of that school, and you've not sat with that kid at breakfast, and you've not made an appointment to see him after school to get a Coke and just to listen to what he has to say. And consequently, what you're saying from the pulpit, though it might be very relevant to the world in which he lives, is not being presented in such a way that it can be readily assimilated into his thinking, because you don't know the thought forms by which he represents his particular problem. Even though they may be common, you don't know the thought forms to which to appeal. And thus, he doesn't hear what you're saying as being applicable to him, because we're not listening. But if this whole thing, and particularly what Art has been sharing these last couple of minutes, is to be really effective, then the two things of the priority of people and your willingness to listen to what they have to say are going to be fundamental, or it just will never exist. And for preachers to have people as a priority and to take time to listen is really not too typical today.
Okay, Art, will you come on back up here and sit? And if you have any questions, just raise your hand and address them to Art. You can feel it.
Yeah.
With the advent of the drugs, one of the problems I had was when I came on the on high school campuses, at first they thought I was a narcotics man trying to catch them for, you know, catch a pusher or something like this. Did you ever have any this type of problem?
Sure, I kid with them. They ask me, "What are you doing over here?" I'm a narc. No, the minute you get defensive on those things and you try and explain yourself away, you're in trouble. So you either got to humor it, or you got to just tell them no, you know, and tell them what you are. And I tell you, it was easier when I was in Young Life to explain what I am than what I am now. I mean, when I was in Young Life, and somebody said, "What are you doing?" I say, "I'm with Young Life," and they said, "What's that?" And I could say, "Well, we're kind of like the Y," or I could say I'm a radical religionist, you know. I mean, you have the whole scope. You can build your own meaning into it. But if they ask you now, "What are you doing?" I work for a church. That pretty well lays it out there. You know, I'm a minister. So you might as well say what you are and deal with it. I have had a problem with people wondering if I'm in that or if I'm gay, you know. But I just have to either humor it or just have to tell them I'm from a church and just dispel it. Usually there's other kids with me and they'll explain.
I was just going to ask you how you approached the principal, say, of the school. What did you tell him? What did you let me know?
Easier now as a minister with a principal than it was with Young Life, because I come from a recognized institution in the community that's doing something, and he recognizes that. So I just asked permission. I told him what our youth program was for information's sake, and I told him why I wanted to come over here at lunch to meet with kids, not for church business, but for friendship's sake, and told him I just really enjoy having lunch with kids. They're my friends. He said, "Fine. In fact, if you got any more people that'll do that, bring them over." You see, because in our particular neighborhood, we want people to come in and help control situations in the schools. Yeah.
What do you wear when you go to these schools?
What I got on? Yeah, no. You know, you can't wear your uniform. And a uniform is a coat and tie. And so just dress natural. I don't dress down. I don't dress down, but I don't dress up. I'm casual, yeah.
I not take necessarily violent exception to what you're saying, except that, for instance, in our area, we've had a very big Jesus movement that has really spread rapidly through North Jersey over a period of about 3 years, starting with a very small Nazarene church in New Milford. And the guy that heads that whole thing up, a Nazarene minister, wears a clergy collar everywhere he goes. And he finds that it's a matter of not recognizing that kids might react to it, but having built a new content into the thinking of kids, rather than saying, "I can't wear that, that'll tie me into the church, I look like a straight guy," he has come across to some of these kids, and it's taken time for them to begin to say, "Hey, that's kind of the symbol of the man, is the collar." And to see Paul Moore, and John McGarvey knows him, some others maybe from North Jersey, see him in a Jesus Joy concert, for instance, with Danny Taylor and the Maranatha Rock and all the rest, come walking out with his long hair and his cleric collar on. And I'm not sure, but that maybe sometimes it's more of a hang-up to us than it is to a lot of kids that we wear. I'm a shirt and tie guy. I just feel very comfortable that way and do everywhere I go. I like to have that shirt when you're done with it, but
let's put it this way. Let comfortability be the guide there. I wouldn't feel comfortable in a coat and tie around a high school in the city. But maybe he does, maybe you do, and maybe he feels comfortable with a collar. So maybe come with what you're comfortable in. But don't feel you've got to wear your uniform, whatever that is. I spend time in the faculty lounge. Yeah, right. And the faculty lounge is a very stimulating place to be. It really is. And you'll get all sorts of reactions in there. And don't forget that those are the people that spend most of the time with those kids. In a lot of respects, those people are putting more content into kids' minds than anyone else is in terms of content. And the way they teach is very important. And we got some real screwballs.
We really do. And you just wonder, you know, who's making teachers accountable for what they have to teach? And I don't think you can come back down with a legal hand. I think that's the place for a Christian to enter into dialogue with a lot of these people. Because I think the Christian can speak to some of these things. In love, not in hostility. So I do the same thing with faculty people that I do with kids. Build bridges. And that's important. Yeah.
It's nice to call kids by their name to get people in the church to do that. But I know I've worked in a city-type church, like you said, where people don't even know each other, much less the other kids' names. Is there any way to stimulate both your adult population and the children to that?
Okay, we have a Wednesday night. It's been a traditional Wednesday night program, that is a prayer meeting. And what we've done this last year, we have shifted to serendipity suppers, we call them. We call them that because we use Lyman Coleman's serendipity stuff. And we are using it with people on Wednesday nights that are from junior high through 80 years old. And we find that a great mix, and we found some real fellowship in there. And we're beginning with that core group to begin to move out in this kind of thing. We've got about 50 people that come to suppers. I wish there were more, but they're threatened by it. You know, they really are. And anything that has to do with group encounters, no matter how you serve it up, it all comes out the same way. You can call it suppers. You can call it serendipity. You can call it fun. You can call it anything you want. It's all the same thing to them. But we're starting to move out in that area with the small groups.
We'll have to go ahead and break off now, and if any of the rest of them have questions, they can just come on forward. But we'll dismiss for now, and 7 o'clock tonight, Jim will be speaking on the family approach, and Art will be continuing with the urban ministry.
Thank you, Bill.
They start serving now, so they don't want to miss that.
Yeah, that's right.
Well, they invited you by grace rather than age.